A DePaul University psychologist, Dr. Irma Halfter, has proved beyond any question of a doubt, through years of carefully documented studies, that our ability to learn improves with age. In other words, the old saying, you can't teach an old dog new tricks, may pertain to dogs, but does not apply to human beings. Someone once used that saying to Dr. Robert Hutchins, I believe it was, and he replied, people are not dogs, and knowledge is not a bag of tricks. Dr. Halfter has given new hope and renewed ambition to older people who thought the world had passed them by and that they can never compete mentally with the young. So significant are her findings that more than 600 schools, colleges, universities, government departments, and other interested organizations have asked for copies of her studies, which began when she was a candidate for her doctorate at the University of Chicago. According to Frank Hughes, who dug up the story, she has proved that older adults do about 10% better in the same circumstances, the same classrooms, than their younger companions. Now, her study of learning ability covered virtually every field of human activity: business, communications, education, humanities, modern languages, natural sciences, mathematics, nursing, professional art, professional music, and social studies. She experimented with groups of older women, but she's proved the same story with men. Sex makes no difference in learning ability. As the doctor reported on her tests with women, older women gave a superior total performance and a superior performance in each of the fields of study. In particular, the older women earned more A's than the younger women and had approximately equal percentages of B's and C's and a lesser percentage of D's and F's. One of Dr. Halfter's pet peeves is this business of college for everybody. She says, one of my pet gripes in industry is that they don't need college graduates. They have so routinized industry that the college degree is really foolishness. I think all of society is on the wrong kick on this. College is a way to keep young people out of the labor force, but industry has so routinized jobs that decision-making is gone. So what do you think of that? Her important contribution is that our ability to learn is not impaired with the advance of the years. On the contrary, it gets better. People going back for their college degrees in their 60s find little difficulty in keeping up with the younger classmates. So it isn't your chronological age that matters in the learning process. It's your functional age. And if you're functioning normally, you can learn anything you want to, and on the average, you'll do better than you would have done in your late teens and early 20s. Now, I think this is good to know. I'm sure the very young are as glad to learn about this as are their parents and grandparents. So if you hear anyone saying, I'm too old to take that up now, you straighten him out. Remember Dr. Hutchins' comeback. The next time you hear someone say you can't teach old dogs new tricks, tell him that people are not old dogs, nor knowledge a bag of tricks. I ran across a quotation that's just too good to pass up. It's by George Bernard Shaw from Back to Methuselah. Imagination is the beginning of creation. You imagine what you desire, you will what you imagine, and at last you create what you will. One of our major problems as persons is that we so often permit our imagination to be confined by our environment and conditions. One of the wonderful things about human imagination is that it can break out of the barriers that tend to limit us physically. It can fly away to greener hills. It can see things not as they are now, but as they can be. It can foretell the future, at least as far as we as persons are concerned, to an altogether unsuspected extent. It can draw the colorful mental images that we hope someday to turn into reality. Imagination is the beginning of creation. We imagine thousands of things, of course, but if we understand the power of imagination, we realize that that upon which our imagination becomes fixed tends to turn into reality. This is good and bad. Just as we can imagine wonderful things and conditions, we can also imagine unhappy, tragic situations. And whatever our imaginations become fixed upon will tend to become real in our lives. That's why control of the mind is so important. Control in the way we control a car. We want it to take us where we want to go. We don't want it to take us into a ditch or into another car. And so we're alert, and we control its speed and direction. It's the only way to drive successfully. Controlling the imagination, or freeing it along positive, growth-directed lines, will lead us in that direction. If we decide upon a goal we think is right and worthy of us, our imagination becomes like a pair of hands holding the picture in our minds, holding it and feeling every part of it, exploring it, turning it over, loving it. And as we hold that picture in the hands of our imagination, we're led toward it. The enormous power of our minds is set the task of achieving it, and the amazing answers begin to come to the surface of our minds. Soon, depending upon the difficulty and complexity of the image, it is ours. It's real. It exists in the world. It is an entity where before it was only a picture in our imagination. Children have an overabundance of imagination, but it's rampant and uncontrolled, which is as it should be as children. As we grow older, we can put the power of our imagination to marvelous use. We can make of it a servant, a genie, to bring us anything we seriously decide upon, or its equivalent. George Bernard Shaw knew this when he wrote those lines. It's not a new formation. It's as old as philosophy itself. But few of us realize it can put it, this self-fulfilling prophecy, to use for good in our lives. Let me give you that quotation again. Imagination is the beginning of creation. You imagine what you desire, you will what you imagine, and at last you create what you will. My old friend Commander Edward Whitehead, chairman of the board of Schweppes USA Limited, made a talk some time back before the United States Naval Institute, which was so popular they printed it. And in this speech, he talked of the difficulty in finding the kind of men who can make it into top management. The title of his speech was How to Succeed by Really Trying. And in it, he said, trying, sustained effort, guts, resilience, the ability to spring back after defeat and discouragement, as well as some measure of ability, are the prerequisites of success. He said moral courage, a vigorous approach to problems, coupled with some degree of tact and preferably some personal charm, marks out the individual from the herd. As an employer, I can tell you that I'm immediately impressed by a young man who differs with me, who takes a different standpoint and does not hesitate to say so. Clearly, if he's going to survive, he must be right on at least some occasions. Also, his manner and approach must be respectful. But it never ceases to amaze me how few are willing to question, to challenge, still less reject the viewpoint pontificated by the boss. In the BBC broadcast, Talk on Management Succession, his late boss, Sir Frederick Hooper, Commander Whitehead said, who is regarded as something of an expert in this field, referred to the difficulties of finding the right men to succeed in top management. He explained why he had learned to reject the specialist, the expert who developed such a penchant for his own particular field that he was seldom able to see a thing whole, to take the broad view. Even the all-rounder, the solid, reliable, capable administrator who ponders each and every problem and eventually comes up with an answer that is probably right, is not the man for top management, he said. The best candidate is likely to be the difficult, intractable fellow who gets under the skin of those above, below, and around him, the chap with insatiable curiosity, who challenges accepted notions, who will never accept anything, who always asks questions and wants to know if there might not be a better way. The Spanish adjective simpatico cannot be translated directly into English, but the man who can be so described and who also possesses sensitivity and empathy is certainly a jump ahead of the field. The capacity to get quickly on terms with the other person, to tune in on his wavelengths, to be able to judge his reactions to what you say is an invaluable attribute. If you have it, you know at once how far you can go, whether to suggest, persuade, flatter, cajole, or beat him over the head. This tells a young man full of steam and ideas how far he can go in forcing them upon a reluctant boss. The extent to which this quality is present is immediately conveyed to the man whose opinion you're trying to influence. If it's there, if he feels that you are simpatico, he will listen and be disposed to do what you want him to do. Some ideas on how to get to the top are how to pick people for top management jobs. The best candidate is likely to be the difficult, intractable person who gets under the skin of those above, below, and around him, the person with insatiable curiosity, who wants to know if there might not be a better way. Many people, seeing Commander Whitehead in the well-known television commercials, do not realize that behind that famous beard and rich British accent is one of the finest minds in modern business management. His success in introducing his product to the world outside of England, Schweppes Tonic, is legendary. In his talks, he stresses the need for vigor, physical and mental. Feats of creative genius have been performed by ailing men, he said, men who were barely alive. But ordinary mortals cannot hope to emulate genius. For us, it's fair to assume that we can do a good day's work only when we're fit. The mind is a part of the body. It is all of a piece. And only if the body is in good shape does the mind continue to initiate things and function to maximum effect. Going further than that, prodigious efforts, great works, can only be done by a man with a superabundant energy and vigor. This comes sometimes as a gift from God, but if that is not the case, only hard work, years of discipline, years of training will produce the same effect. He goes on to say, personally, I can't even pretend to function efficiently if I'm feeding under the weather. I know, however, that when I'm in normal health, I function almost aggressively, laying about me in all directions at quite a pace. It's tough on my staff, but it gets things done. This vigor stems, I think, from being fitter than most of my contemporaries, and it's not happened by accident. I train for the job. Moreover, I promised myself many years ago that, God willing, I'd live to reap the benefits of my labors. My experience, he goes on to say, indicates that considerations of this kind arise too frequently when it's too late, when a man has exhausted his reserves by years of abuse. Beyond a certain age, it is too late to repair the damage. I attach enormous importance, he said, to this attribute for reasons closely connected with that vital characteristic, resilience, the ability to spring back after defeat. A man needs vigor to stay the course. He must be bursting with it to enable him to ignore setbacks, disregard discouragement, and rise above inevitable deterrence to action, the sheer inertia or the indifference of others. Only a man of vision, which is an unquenchable spirit and immense vigor, will press on with his cause in the face of the apathy of those whom he's trying to persuade. Any person who has set out to achieve something that he considers to be worthwhile, whether it be a sacred cause or a personal ambition, will know exactly what I mean. Well, I could not agree with him more. Getting a good idea across to others, getting it implemented, getting it from the idea stage into concrete expression, is one of the world's toughest jobs, and it takes a person in good physical condition to do it. As a general rule, people in top management positions are in surprisingly good condition. Dr. Gene Mayer, professor of nutrition, Harvard University, in a speech before the Charles Allen Thomas Science Symposium in St. Louis, pointed out the sad fact that the United States is constantly slipping with respect to the rest of the world for the average remaining lifetime for men at age 40. We've gone from 11th in 1966 to 40th and 9th to 23rd for women. And of all causes of death, cardiovascular death is the big problem. 1 million such deaths in each of the past 3 years, with three-quarters of these having been coronaries. That for almost half of our men in the 40 to 60-year range, death is the result of heart disease, means that we have returned unwittingly to the days of the great pandemics, like the great plagues of the 14th century, when a quarter or a half of the population died of one disease. And this American phenomenon is probably a preview of what will happen in all industrial societies eventually. Dr. Mayer went on to point out that among causes of cardiovascular death and crippling, obesity is the major factor, as it is with diabetes and liver disease. Obesity is a complex syndrome where genetic and environmental factors interact, and in some cases, traumatic factors are also involved. Our studies show that it can be due to disturbances in the function of regulatory mechanisms, of which the better known are situated in a part of the brain known as the hypothalamus. We're beginning to understand the mechanism of action of these centers well enough to imagine the possibility of a magic bullet depressing the action of the so-called feeding centers. Most obesity, however, appears to be directly the result of our mode of life. She said, I have shown a number of years ago that the mechanism of regulation of food intake works poorly or not at all at very low levels of energy expenditure. As physical work decreases below a certain critical level, determined for each individual by heredity and clearly associated with body type, food intake stops decreasing correspondingly, or decreasing at all, and the individual becomes fat. Obesity is, for many, and probably for most of our overweight population, the result of a technology which, by emphasizing door-to-door individual transportation, labor-saving devices, and televised spectator sports, is affecting unfavorably the health and appearance of close to half of our adults. Lack of exercise does more than lead to obesity. Again, our research shows that hard and prolonged exercise protects against the hypercholesterolemic effects of a high diet in saturated fat, and to a certain extent against hypertension. In the presence of a significant narrowing of the arteries of the heart, it also leads to the opening of collateral vessels, and thus may avert a fatal coronary. It is thus not enough to mention technological approaches to preventing the number one killer and crippler of men in industrial societies. It's even more important to understand that the pandemic prevalence of cardiovascular disease is to a large extent the result of our uncontrolled technology. All of which means, if you want to live a full lifespan, take care of your heart by daily exercise and keep your weight down. So check with your doctor, watch your weight, and exercise every day. It isn't that we want to live forever, but why sacrifice 10 or 20 years of life just because of modern technology? A very interesting United Press International story appeared recently, Dateline New York. It seemed that many companies are faced with the problem of executives who resist taking vacations. According to Dr. Smith Montgomery of Personnel Psychology Center, New York City, and other business psychologists, the man who wants to skip his vacation nearly always is a risk of some kind to the company, and himself. Rarely is his excuse for staying on the job valid. According to Dr. Ralph Collins, consulting psychiatrist for Eastman Kodak Company of Rochester, New York, this executive likely will become dogmatic and irascible at the office, reducing morale and efficiency in his department. There are many executive types who want to skip vacations, virtually all bad, Montgomery said. One is the fellow who's afraid somebody else will be sitting at his desk permanently when he gets back. There's the man who's been covering his mistakes and fears the boss will find him out if he goes on leave. There's the spendthrift who can't afford a vacation. Often he covers up by pretending the company can't spare his services. He manages to have some large project on hand to look after during vacation season. There are those who really think they're indispensable, that the department couldn't get along without them for a few weeks. Another is the fellow who has a business of his own on the side, which he can't leave. If he can't get away for a trip, he can't see any sense in taking leave from his regular job either. And finally, there's the occasional till-tapper. He's the one who has been doing some stealing and juggling the books and is afraid a surprise audit during his absence would mean prison. Employers are not entirely blameless for this vacation problem, said Montgomery. Business psychologists now and then encounter employers who intimidate employees into not taking vacations in order to save the cost of extra summertime help or to avoid losing the sales or services of a valuable employee. This is a good way to lose him permanently. I've known businessmen who refuse to take vacations on the theory that they just can't get away, but I've never known of a really valid case. By not taking his vacation, the boss deprives his family of their vacation fund and deprives the employees the pleasure of his absence for at least a short time during the year. As to being indispensable, that's so much papaya juice. Nobody is indispensable, as much as he might like to think he is. Quite often, much to the consternation of the boss, sales increase during his absence. Things actually run more smoothly, and overdue improvements can often be made. So take your vacation, get away from it all, and get a change of scenery, a fresh attitude, and quite often, some excellent ideas you wouldn't have gotten otherwise. Yes, Virginia, there are those who resist taking vacations, and where you find them, you will also find problems of various kinds. There was once a manager who had all the tact and consideration for the feelings of others as a wounded wolverine. To him, there was only one way to do things, and that was his way. As far as he was concerned, all other human beings, but especially those in his charge, were revolving morons. The slightest mistake found him frothing at the mouth, cursing, shouting, running around like a crazy wind-up toy with hypertension. The turnover rate in his department was practically 100% per year. He belonged to the old school that's fond of saying, if you want something done right, do it yourself. That statement, incidentally, is the most blatantly conceited, stupid remark ever uttered by a creature famous for making stupid remarks. It assumes that no one else on earth can do a particular job as well as I can. That has to be false on the face of it. What the person who says that really means is, if you want something done the same old way, the way you like to see it done, then do it yourself. Anyway, this manager of whom I speak was a problem for the whole company and was fast becoming about as popular as a cute athlete's foot. Finally, it was suggested to him that he have a frank evaluation session with his people, with the idea of reaching better accord and bringing more peace and productivity into his department. The suggestion was made to him by a person of higher authority, so he went along with it. He got his people together and leveled with them. He wanted their opinions of him and their suggestions as to how their department could be more efficiently operated. Well, it was a revelation. The manager learned that he was not held in high esteem by his people, that they only tolerated his thoughtless and dictatorial methods because of the paycheck. But the most revealing and interesting question came from one of the youngest men in the department. He asked, "Where did you learn to manage others?" Well, this brought about a deep and prolonged silence. And it turned out that this manager had never studied management at all. He'd never in his life read a single book on management techniques or how to get along well with other human beings. It seems that he had taken it for granted that management ability came along as standard equipment, like a navel at birth. He learned, in fact, that he didn't know the first thing about managing others, and that it might be a good idea if he gave a little thought to the subject, which he did. He began to study everything he could find on the subject. He built a fine library of materials on good management and became, in the process, a very good manager. The turnover in his department dropped to normal. People walked around smiling and whistling for a change, and productivity soared. The moral of the little story is that if you're a manager, have some frank, no-holds-barred evaluation sessions with your people. Tell them that what they say will have no effect on their jobs, and then listen. Getting along well with other people is still the world's most needed skill. With it, there's no limit to what a person can do. We need people. We need the cooperation of others. There's really very little that we can do alone. A really good novel is a rare and wonderful thing. We look forward to getting back to it, and we hate to put it down. Even though we rush through it, we hate to see it come to an end. You'll occasionally hear someone make the comment that he reads only nonfiction. In nonfiction, we seldom see the real truth, as far as people are concerned, except for those books about people written by experts. It is in fiction that the truth may be told. We can easily speak the deepest truth about ourselves when we're putting the words in the mouth of a so-called fictional character. Fictional characters can do or say anything, and we are safe and can say, well, it's only fiction. About the novel, Henry James wrote, "The advantage, the luxury, as well as the torment and responsibility of the novelist, is that there's no limit to what he may attempt as an executant, no limit to his possible experiments, efforts, discoveries, successes." This is what makes writing a novel so exciting a thought to so many people. There's simply no limit as to what may be attempted. But, and this is the but that usually stands between the so-called novelist and his readers. Henry James also said, "The only obligation to which in advance we may hold a novel, without incurring the accusation of being arbitrary, is that it be interesting." To be interesting, there's the rub. Because to be interesting, you've got to be good. You have to write in such a way that the words themselves, the little black marks on the printed page, disappear, and only the thoughts and ideas and action and the drama, the smoothly flowing dialogue, come through. The legend at the beginning of a good novel, the disclaimer about the characters being fictitious and any resemblance to persons living or dead being purely coincidental, is, of course, so much hogwash. The characters are not fictional. They're real. They are people we've met many times or read about in our daily newspaper. Novelists take their characters from real life, changing only the names and places to avoid suit for libel, not for misrepresentation, but for all too accurate a picture of the real person. To get an education, we've got to read a great deal of nonfiction. To be a successful writer, one needs reference books of various sorts, the more the better, all of which are nonfiction. Most of our reading is nonfiction, and that's fine. But if you've never tried good fiction, or have gotten out of the habit of reading good fiction, try it again. I had a letter the other day from a woman, a widow, who lives in the South. She said she found much of her existence rather bleak. Good fiction will bring a whole new, exciting, colorful world into our lives. The person who loves books is never very lonely for long. The pages of his books are filled with interesting people who wait his pleasure, ready to entertain at a moment's notice. Yes, a really good novel is a rare and wonderful thing. I've finished 3 excellent novels in the past couple of weeks, and I always keep a couple in my briefcase when I travel. In Saul Bellow's excellent novel, Mr. Sammer's Planet, published by Viking, he writes, "Underneath there persists, powerfully too, a fixed sense of what is normal for human life. Duties are observed, attachments are preserved, there is work. People show up for jobs. It's extraordinary. They come on the bus to the factory. They open the shop. They sweep. They wrap. They wash. They fix. They tend. They count. They tend the computers. Each day, each night. And however rebellious at heart, however despairing, terrified, or worn bare, come to their tasks. Up and down in the elevator, sitting down to the desk, behind the wheel, tending machinery. For such a volatile and restless animal, such a high-strung, curious animal, an ape subject to so many diseases, to anguish, boredom, such discipline, such drill, such strength for regularity, such assumption of responsibility, such regard for order, even in disorder, is a great mystery, too. Oh, it is a mystery. One cannot mistake this for thorough madness, therefore. One thing, though, the disciplined hate the undisciplined to the point of murder. Thus the working class, disciplined, is a great reservoir of hatred. Thus the clerk behind the wicket finds it hard to forgive those who come and go in apparent freedom. And the bureaucrat, glad when disorderly men are killed. All of them. Killed. Well, that's one of the best pieces of writing I've come across in some time, and it's one of the reasons I like to read Saul Bellow. He makes you think. He makes you go back and read a paragraph over again. He pulls you up and puts all your mind to work. Surely we've all wondered why people stay in their traces instead of jumping out of them. People show up for jobs. It's extraordinary. They open the shop, they sweep, they wrap, they wash, they fix, they tend the computers, each day, each night. And however rebellious at heart, however despairing, terrified, or worn bare, come to their tasks, up and down in the elevator, sitting down to the desk, behind the wheel, tending machinery. Yes, it's a great mystery. Except that they do what they have been taught to do. They follow the examples of those who have gone before. Once in a great while, a bus driver will take off for Florida with his bus, or a newspaper man will sail alone across the Atlantic, but 99.99%, however rebellious at heart, however despairing, terrified, or worn bare, come to their tasks. How about you? Love your work? Love your life? Happy? Like the old neighborhood, the town, the part of the country? Man has been called the responsible animal. As a rule, he sticks with his family, his friends, and his work, and tries to find meaning in it all. And it's a good thing he does. But reading Saul Bellow's words makes you think, doesn't it? And it is true, the disciplined hate the undisciplined to the point of murder. Thus, the working class, disciplined, is a great reservoir of hatred. And the clerk behind the wicket finds it hard to forgive those who come and go in apparent freedom. In a great city, you see the teeming millions working in such order, commuting to and from work, tending their families and mowing their lawns and shoveling snow without question. It's marvelous. And it is a mystery, isn't it? Thank you.